have that kind of speed at launch. So, now, you know, you've got some light of spacecraft, like New Horizon, that's on the way to Pluto. That one did not do any gravity assist at all. But, you know, it's a direct shot. It used an Atlas V with five strap-on rockets to do it. But it doesn't weigh 8,000 pounds. And that won't be getting to Pluto in 2016. And that's going to do a... just going to fly, you know, past. It's not going to go into orbit around Pluto. And it's going to continue out to the Kuiper Belt. And it will eventually leave the solar system. Similar to the Voyagers and the Pioneers. But the difference is New Horizon will never catch the Voyagers. Will never pass them. It doesn't have that speed. In fact, we'll be going about 8,000 miles per hour slower than any of the Voyagers by the time it gets out there. And the reason being is, you know, it didn't have all these gravity assists from the bigger planets. The alignments weren't there. In 1977, when the Voyagers were launched, they realized, look, all these planets are going to be lined up. This isn't going to happen for another 200 years. And they called it, what, the Grand Tour, I think is the word they used, the Grand Tour. And they were going to go visit all the planets except for Pluto, that wasn't in line. And that's another interesting thing. You know, New Horizons, let me drop it. It's going to be going to meet Pluto, but if you ever look at the diagram of the solar system, Pluto is highly, it doesn't have the, it's not along the plane of the ecliptic. It's not, if you have a photograph disk, you know, it's not on that disk. It's tilted some, I think, what is it, 20 degrees or something. But that means they had to time this New Horizon to get to Pluto when Pluto was actually crossing the ecliptic. And it will be doing that in 2015. So, I mean, the engineering, I'm always fascinated by all these gravity assists and how these spacecraft get to wherever they're getting 10, 20, 30 years down the road. And they have to figure all this out. Use the right amount of fuel and proper rocket to do all that. I know they got all computers and everything doing this, but somebody had to put that raw data in there, at, you know, somewhere along the line, Dick. Back to that WS line.
There's one thing you said, Paul, that attracted my attention. You probably have told us in previous weeks, and I'm forgetful, Juno spacecraft that just flew by the Earth when as close as 370 miles is 8,000 pounds. As you said, that's an extremely heavy spacecraft. That's the weight of two good-sized automobiles. What is Juno going to do with 8,000 pounds? Why is it so heavy? When it gets to Jupiter, what does it intend to do? Why is it that heavy, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW.
A lot of people think when they see it, you know, the dimensions, each solar panel is 60 feet long. You have three of them. They're set apart from each other at 120 degrees. So basically, you're looking at, 120-foot long spacecraft. But that's not the major part of the weight. Major part of the weight is in the center. And most spacecraft, you know, they have computers and fuel and things like that. Well, fuel is always adds up to about half the amount of weight. And this thing does have to get into polar orbit, so it's going to do a burn when it gets there. It's not going to have aero braking or anything like that. So that's part of it. But one of the heaviest parts of this spacecraft is this titanium, I forget how thick this titanium boxes, and it's called an electronic box. It's surrounding anything to do with electronics. It's very, very well shielded. Titanium boxes. I mean, it's better than lead when I read it. And they do not want the radiation, a lot of radiation. This thing's going to be dipping low near the atmosphere of Jupiter and then going far out, you know, maybe all the way out to the orbit of Callisto. And that's one of the, you know, the distant Galilean moon. And then it's going to be dipping back in again. But each time it dips back in close to the planet, you're going through a big-time radiation area. They need to have the electronics protected to do this. Remember, Galileo, was put into orbit, stayed into orbit around 10 years until they deorbited that and burnt that up into the atmosphere of Jupiter. But that 10 years, it was kind of protected. It wasn't going deep into the, you know, through the radiation belt. Wasn't going over the North Pole and the South Pole. It was in a, you know, an ecliptic orbit, you might say, so it could visit all the moons of Jupiter. Didn't have this problem that Juno is going to have. So a lot of the weight, they said, is from this titanium box type thing that's in the center of the spacecraft. Back to you.
Yeah, Jupiter, as I understand it, is a very strong radiation planet. In other words, it has the equivalent of a Van Allen belt, but it's probably many times the strength of ours. So as you fly by Jupiter, you get a whole lot of X-rays and whatever. Is that why all of this protection is required? And it's going to be dipping down at low altitude, so it's really going to hit the Jupiter equivalent of the super Van Allen belt. Bunch of guesses on my part. Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, that's what I've read. Van Allen belt is bad enough. This thing is probably, I don't know how many times worse, but big time radiation problem. I guess they must have a huge Van Allen belt. I've seen it in drawings. They have multiple belts similar to what we have. It's not just one belt here. Whatever they have, they need to have a spacecraft survive that. They plan on going in low. You're going into it and out of it, you know, 14 different times. So you would fly the. They said you would fry the electronics on any other type of spacecraft.
And the main thing it's going to do is make measurements, I presume, mostly of Jupiter. Will it be measuring more than one of the Galilean moons? Paul, go ahead.
Basically Jupiter. This thing is going to be investigating Jupiter. Whether they do moons or not, I'm sure they'll probably try to get that in, but if they do, it'll be on the. You know, they're not going to be in the same type of orbit as the moon. I guess they'd have to figure out when that moon is going to be near where the spacecraft is. But, it's primarily a Jupiter investigating type of spacecraft. Plasma, ions. Jupiter emits radio waves, tremendous amount of radio waves. Naturally, it's not intelligent with radio waves, but radio waves they are. And that's what the wave instrument is going to detect. That's the one that the ham translated the high message for. It's got ultraviolet, infrared cameras on board, some other science equipment. It's going to be able to find out exactly what the atmosphere consists of. It's going to go in pretty low. All kinds of, I think, 8 or 10 test instruments on board that spacecraft. I think it's 8.
Fantastic. Anybody with any final questions for Paul? Because right now, what I'm planning to do is to give Eric the answer to his question of last week, and then we'll go over to west in that order. So anybody with any final questions for Paul before we leave the space portion, give me your call letters right now, K2LIW. Okay, let's see if Eric is on frequency, because he's the guy that asked this question. I hope he's awake so he can hear one of the answers. KE2EJ, are you on board? K2LIW? How about that? Maybe we put him to sleep. One last call. Let's see if Eric is around. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Probably went to Carvel.
Okay. Well, what's the best flavor you should get there, John? What do you think?
Straight ahead and hungry.
Okay. Alrighty. I'll reverse the order then. To me, it's exciting material that I've discovered. We'll go to West first, and then even if Eric's not back, I'll give you this information that I discovered about the impedance of space. It's very different than you think. Wes, I know that one of the things that you mailed us this week, and I think it was also on Bernie's website, is this set of lectures that took place this week. I think it was a three-day series, and very interesting-sounding subjects, a little bit futuristic-sounding, like cold fusion, for instance. And I think cold fusion is still considered a little bit controversial. Let me drop.
Same day.
Oh, is Eric back? Is that Eric that I just heard?
Yeah, K2, yeah.
Okay. I proposed an experiment. Assume that I've got two transmitters that are each exactly 100 watts. And I'm going to connect the two transmitters to an ordinary half-wave dipole. Transmitter number one is operating at 100 megahertz, and it's a 100-watt transmitter. Transmitter number two is operating at 10 gigahertz, and it's a 100-watt transmitter. Both cases are going into a half-wave dipole. Half-wave dipole, everybody knows, it's got a gain of 2.14 dB. Let me drop. So because the gain of the dipole is 2.14 dB, that's a ratio of 1.64, the 100 watts going into the dipole, as long as you're both sides of the dipole, you think you're looking at 164 watts. That is your ERP, effective radiated power. So each dipole, the 100-watt transmitter, and the 1.64 gain means you've got 164 watts of apparent power, of ERP, coming out of each of these dipoles. One dipole is on 10 gigs, and a dipole at 10 gigs is half an inch long. The dipole at 100 megs, that's a half wavelength long, is 50 inches long. So half an inch and 50 inches long are the two dipoles. Assuming now that the radio frequency MIO has it, I'm going to go by the old standards. Let me drop. The old standard used to be 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. You shouldn't exceed for continuous exposure of a human being. In the last few years, they've become more conservative and they've lowered it to 1. But let me use the 10 number because I'm more familiar with it. 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. You're allowed to expose a human being with that continuously, and it was considered safe. Beyond that, they weren't so sure it's safe. So 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, which happens to equal 100 watts per square meter. 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, and there's 10,000 square centimeters in a square meter, you end up with 100 watts. So 100 watts per square meter, and what's interesting about that is that a human being has an area, a skin area, of roughly 1 square meter. You lie on the beach, on your beach blanket, with your bathing suit on in the summertime, and at high noon, that sun is hitting you, and the sun has got something like 1,200 watts per square meter. 1,200 watts of solar energy is hitting your body when you lie on the beach in the summertime at high noon. Your body can handle that. As long as a little bit of wind blowing and your body can evaporate, there's some moisture inside, you handle that fairly nicely. And all of the theories up till now, of all of the 60 years that we've been studying radio frequency biohazard, let me drop. We have never confirmed any effect other than thermal. Everybody's been looking for the non-thermal effect, where you think the radio energy is directly coupling into the nervous system and changing body chemistry and whatever. Every so often somebody does an experiment and they think they see something, and he publishes an article in a peer-reviewed journal. And a bunch of other people try to duplicate the exact same experiment, and they don't get the same result. So it's controversial. It looks like 99% of what radio energy does when it hits you is the amount that gets absorbed gets turned into heat. And so we're allowing 100 watts per square centimeter. In the old days, it's now 100 watts per square meter. And your body is roughly a square meter. So you're allowed to, in the old days, irradiate a person with 100 watts total on his whole body of RF energy. And now it's 10 watts is all you're allowed. But the sun gives you 1,200 watts. And when it comes to thermal energy, a 100-watt light bulb, an incandescent light bulb, is really giving out 100 watts of thermal energy. And you have to ask yourself, how far do I have to be from a 100-watt light bulb until it's safe? I mean, every one of us has read under a 100-watt light bulb that was 3 feet away. And do we ever worry about the thermal energy coming out of that light bulb and whether or not it's putting your body at risk? Let me drop it. Anyhow, with the old standard, with 164 watts of ERP of these two transmitters, how far do you have to be safe, 10 milliwatts per square centimeter? And the answer is 11.8 feet. So if you're 11.8 feet away from that dipole, in each case, the exact same power of transmitter, two different sizes of dipole, but the exact same antenna gain on both, the exact same antenna pattern on both, even though there are 101 different in frequency. In either case, if you're 11.8 feet away, you're giving a 10 milliwatts per square centimeter is one way of putting the units of exposure. 100 watts per square meter is another. Or another way of looking at it is 194 volts per meter. You're creating a power flux density of 100 watts per square meter or 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, and you're creating an E field of 194 volts per meter. But notice that both transmitters produce the exact same 194 volts per meter. Both transmitters produce the exact same watts per square meter. Both have the exact same dangerous distance, 11.8 feet. But in one case, I'm coupling that energy into the universe, into the atmosphere. Let me drop it. In one case, I'm doing that at 10 gigs with a half-inch long dipole. In the other case, at 100 megs, I'm doing it with a 50-inch long dipole. They both give me the exact same results. So you can sit here and say, well, I think the antenna is giving me an impedance match to the 377 ohms of space, and yet I've got a 100-to-1 difference in the size of the dipole that's doing it. In both cases, I'm coupling that energy into space with the exact same efficiency. In one case, in both cases, I'm producing exactly 194 volts per meter, but look at the huge difference in the size of the antennas, 100-to-1 difference in size of the antenna that does it. Which one of those antennas is giving me the correct impedance match to space? The answer is both of them. They both run at roughly 100% efficiency. All the energy I put into those dipoles, in both cases, 99.9% of it is radiated to space, and it does that. To me, that's a fairly strong piece of evidence that when you and I construct an antenna, Eric, let me drop it. Our highest priority is to make sure the antenna is resonant. Once it's resonant and that energy is bouncing back and forth in the antenna, it's building up this great big magnetic field. The magnetic field is what gets radiated into space. And are you impedance matching? Uh-huh. You just all you're doing is obeying the law of conservation of energy. You're putting energy into this thing, and if you've done a good job of designing its length and its impedance matching, which is pretty easy in both cases, 70 ohm impedance, so you're using 70 ohm twin leads in both cases, just create the resonance and the rest happens. By the same token, if I was doing it with feed horns, if I was using a standard gain horn, 15 dB gain horn, the horn at 10 gigahertz would have a width of the mouth of the horn of about 3 inches. On 1 gigahertz, I've used the horn at 1 gigahertz, and they call it the coal hopper. The darn thing is about 3 feet wide is the mouth of the horn. And both of them are giving you the exact same impedance match. So I don't think we impedance match the space, Eric. we just create a resonating circuit that radiates the energy and let Mother Nature absorb it any way she wants to. KE2EJ, K2RIW, with a bunch of opinions.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Now, I see exactly your point. The thing that got me going with the literature that's written, and I looked at the formulas a little bit more, and when you try to calculate what the impedance of space is, it doesn't quite work out to what you think it does. But, no, I understand your point completely, because if you've got it to resonate in reality, the impedance of space is irrelevant. You know, I mean, you might as well just call it zero. P2IOW, KE3J.
And yet the way you and I suffered through a fields and wave course, we were led to believe that by all those magic Maxwell equations, we never were told how, but by some magic that we weren't told, it was giving an impedance match to space. I don't think you have to. Does that light bulb have to impedance match to space in order to radiate its signal? Of course not. As long as it's not shielded, as long as it's hot enough to emit energy, it's going to go out in space no matter what the heck the impedance of space is. So, what really is an antenna? How do you really design one? Do we give our students in our electrical engineering schools useful engineering information by which they can design the most important component of every wireless system? The most important component, arguably, is the antenna. The transmitter can be perfect, the receiver can be perfect, the feed line can be perfect. Without an antenna, you've got nothing. So, if you're a smart person building a wireless system, particularly in the case of an airborne radar system, you better put most of your energy into that antenna first. You design a darn good antenna, and in the case of an airplane, you make sure it's got very low side lobes looking at the Earth, because the Earth's reflected side lobes and an airborne antenna will kill you. They'll knock out your dynamic range immediately. You got nothing left. You make sure it's got an antenna with good low side lobes toward the Earth. You make sure it's got a good radome in front of it that aerodynamically is not going to do terrible things to your airplane and its performance. And once you've got that antenna and that radome, then it's time to start hanging some electronics onto it. And eventually you've got a radar system. I've watched a company do it in reversed order. And they were fighting and fighting that system for 3 solid years. And they went down the tubes with eventually the declaration it was that you guys better never submit a bid again on an airborne radar system because you did such a bad job. And that particular program I'm describing literally closed down the radar department of a company where the major product was radar. So there's a lot to be said in the way we teach antennas, a lot of improvement. Any further questions or comments, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
I need to correct what I just said. Think of it. If you think of the impedance as zero, if you run the formula, because I can calculate that. I went through the exercise of calculating what the E field and the H field look like in terms of, you know, three-dimensional polar graphs. If the impedance was zero, which makes perfect sense in terms of, you know, no resistance or, per se, no impedance resistance value in an AC circuit. But when you actually do those calculations, if you set it to zero, it's not going to work. It's got to be one. There's got to be more than nothing. So, but in the end, it's really irrelevant because whatever the system is that you're creating to make that match to the dipole so that it is resonant, that's where it all has to work. Actually, when you add at that point of resonance, now you can actually calculate what the field itself looks like.
And I think that's true. For traditional reasons, we all think the dipole has to be fed in the center. Absolutely not. That dipole is a highly resonant thing, energy is going to bounce back and forth in it a whole lot of times before it finally gets radiated into space. And so it's a little bit like putting energy into a flywheel. I can decide to put the energy in the flywheel by using a push rod that's very close to the pivot point, somewhere in between the pivot point and the perimeter, or the perimeter. That's my choice. I can make it a high impedance, low impedance, or a medium impedance way that I feed energy into the flywheel. It doesn't matter. As long as the energy gets into the flywheel, it's going to turn, and you've got kinetic energy of rotation. A dipole is the exact same thing. I can feed it in the center. I can feed it halfway from the center to the outer edge, or I can feed it at the outer edge. And I'll get 100% efficiency in all three positions if I know what I'm doing. And the nice thing about deciding to feed it in some other place is I've got 72 ohms in the center and resonance. Halfway between the center and the outer edge, I can probably find a place where it's 300 ohms. If I feed the outer edge of the dipole, I'm seeing something like 1,500 ohms. And with a simple L network, one inductor, one capacitor, I step up the impedance, and I feed it there. And depending on what you're doing, there are times when that's a huge advantage. What Mel was doing, let me drop it. K2KEY said he took a piece of green insulated wire, hung it from the evergreen tree out in front of his house. It's a half-wave vertical dipole hanging from the tree, and he fed it at the bottom with reference to ground. Didn't need a whole bunch of ground plane radios. Worked like a charm. John, KC2WGB, K2LIW. Go ahead, John.
I got one more thing, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Here's the thing that I'm trying to work out. Okay. Let's say your 100 megahertz antenna, 100 megahertz dipole is 50 inches, right? So, in essence, my source impedance in this case is going to be around, 72 ohms, 73 ohms, something like that. Now I shorten it to, say, 35 inches. I now have to make up the difference somewhere along the line to make a match. And in essence, the only way I can visualize this in terms of efficiency, now you're saying it's 100% efficient, as long as I make that match. So either because it is out of megahertz and the wavelength is 50 inches, even though I may only have 35 inches of physical wire, now let me put it to you this way. Let me ask the question, am I still bouncing back and forth between 35 inches, or do I just imagine that it's 50 inches and my energy is bouncing back and forth that full 50 inches? K2IW, K2J.
The best answer in the world is the real empirical data by Brown and Woodward, 1948. They spent a year of their life doing that. When you go from the 100-inch dipole where it's a half wavelength long, 180 degrees long, and you go down to 30-some-odd inches in your example, instead of being 180 degrees long, it's 150 degrees long. And those curves are for monopoles. You need to divide everything by two. So 150 is what? It'll be 75 degrees long as a monopole. You go to the Brown-Woodward curve, and you look at 75 degrees instead of 90 degrees for a monopole, your shortened dipole, you'll find that the 35 ohms on their graph, which equals the 70 ohms for you and me when we feed it as a dipole, the 70 ohms probably went down to, I'm going to pick a number, 20 ohms. So the resistive component went to 20 ohms. The reactance used to be no reactance. You've now probably got a reactance of, I'm not sure, but maybe it's 1,000 ohms, of capacitive reactance. Whenever a dipole is too short, it is a capacitor. So it's now a 20-ohm resistor with 1,000 ohms of capacitor reactance. You simply put 1,000 ohms of inductive reactance in series with the feed point, the reactance goes away, and as long as you've got the right kind of an impedance matching device where you can feed 20 ohms of resistive component instead of 70 ohms, you're there. You've re-established resonance. The energy is bouncing back and forth on a shorter dipole. The amount of radiation as that energy goes down the dipole, it's now traveling a shorter distance. It's got less real estate to radiate into. A smaller percentage got radiated on the first pass. As such, instead of the signal bouncing back and forth 20 times, it's now going to bounce back and forth 120 times.
But after the 120 times, that because you forced it into resonance by putting in that 1,000 ohm reactance inductor, it's now back to resonant. All of those bounces are co-phased. They're in step with each other. The magnetic field gets built up, a little stronger magnetic field this time, because you've got higher Q. So the shorter distance is producing a stronger magnetic field over that shorter distance, and you therefore still radiate all the same power, but now it's 200 bounces instead of 20 bounces, if you know what I mean. So did you make it electronically act like it was half wave? Yes, you could look at it that way. You made it shorter. Let me drop.
Well, you know, the wavelength is the wavelength. I mean, it may be making the wire shorter than the length of the wave, yes?
The wire is shorter than the length of the wave is a good way of putting it. But as long as the signal bouncing back and forth, which it always does in every reasonable size antenna, as long as it bounces back and forth and all those bounces stay in step with each other and you build up that beautiful magnetic field and the strong E field, but the E field doesn't do you much good because you're not going to launch any electrons in space. You're launching a magnetic field and you've now built up a stronger magnetic field, and now after 200 bounces instead of 20 bounces, you still radiate all the energy. You still coupled it into space. The shorter length still coupled it into space. And if you want to look at it as an impedance match to space, how in the world did the shorter one on the exact same frequency do the exact same job as the longer one? The exact same gain, by the way. Within half a dB, you only lose half a dB as you go down the infinitesimal dipole. Let me drop.
Yeah, but now are you saying that there is a delay in time between the time you start adding energy to the antenna until the time it begins to radiate?
If you're talking about the rise time, when you first turned on the transmitter, yes. Every higher Q resonator has a longer rise time and a longer fall time. However, when you usually analyze an antenna, we look at it in steady state. It's been running for a while. But if you want to produce 1 nanosecond pulses, and you're therefore worrying about the rise time of building up the energy in the antenna, the shorter antenna, brought back into resonance, is now a higher Q, and by definition, a higher Q has a longer rise time and a longer fall time if you're trying to produce very brief pulses into it. It's pretty much the same physics. Over to you, Eric, KQLIW.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, that's what makes sense to me. I mean, that can be a problem when you're talking about radar or, you know, something where you're trying to measure things in relation to time, but in a steady state, no, I can fully understand that. And by the way, that's not explained anywhere. And also, by the way, I tried doing the calculations in terms of working out the E-field by making it shorter and changing the impedance that I need to do the matching with and making up for the capacitive reactance. The shape is still the same.
You've got it. The antenna pattern stays the same. The half dB of broadside gain that you lose when you go down to an infinitesimal size, the half dB you lose, is not inefficiency half a dB. It's because you're using a little bit less real estate, therefore the 78 degree beamwidth becomes 85 degree width. The pattern becomes a little bit fatter. That's the way the gain got lower. But you still radiate every bit of the energy as long as you're smart enough to choose materials that don't have I squared R loss in them. Over to you, Eric, KQLIW.
No, I definitely hear you. And the one thing that I did notice is that the calculations of the aperture, it changes, but not by much.
The gain only changed by half a dB, therefore the aperture only changed by half a dB, which is what, a few percent. Gain is 4 pi A over lambda squared, or A is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. If you know the gain, and you know the frequency, you know the area. And the area only changed by half a dB. You still got 95% of the area, if you know what I mean. And how can an extremely short piece of wire, when receiving, have the exact same effective capture area as the full half-wave dipole? That's the magic of resonance. The higher Q does all that for you. It creates a stronger magnetic field. It takes a little longer to build up that field. And by the way, with the exception of these nanosecond-like super fast radars, ultra-wideband radars. Let me drop them. In rare cases, most of the time, the rise time of an antenna doesn't bother you. For usual kinds of data rates, voice and whatever, and even video, the rise time of the antenna, you and I almost never see it because it's down in the picoseconds and nanoseconds most of the time. Only if you're making an ultra-wideband radar do you run into the problem of the rise time of the antenna. And there's a way you can build the antenna in a Vivaldi-like configuration where you can even get that back to. You can make the instantaneous bandwidth of the antenna so wide that the Q comes back down, if you know what I mean. So very rarely do we run into a problem of the rise time of the antenna being the limiting factor. Most likely it's the rise time of your transmitter and the feed line and the impedance matching network and your antenna tuner. That's where quite a bit of the rise time really comes from. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Hi, Dick. I like your explanation. It works for me. Go ahead, take John's question. And that is really good thinking, Ed. It kind of bothered me a little bit when I asked you last week. That's why I did a little more investigating in it. So, K2RW, K2J.
You haven't heard the end of this. There's a lot more to the story. We haven't taught antenna engineering, per se, in the United States, in any of our schools, by my standards. We haven't taught that in the last 60 years. KC2WGB, he's going to solve this problem. K2RW, go ahead, John.
By the way, sorry, did you put any thought to what I suggested to you last week?
Mentally, I've been composing some of that, sort of, yes. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick. Yep, we're going to solve it. I just wanted to ask you, if you remember, you just described about 5 minutes ago two different horns that you were using. Could you remember your description and say that again?
Yeah, I own a standard gain horn for 10 gigahertz. Most of the standard gain horns made by Scientific Atlanta in the early days were almost always 15.5 dB of gain. That was a very convenient gain for a standard gain horn to calibrate an antenna range. The standard gain horn for 10 gigahertz, 8 to 12 gigahertz, that standard gain horn is about 3 inches wide, 2.5 inches high, is the open mouth of that horn. And the horn itself tapers down to a waveguide to coax adapter, a WR90 waveguide in the back, and the whole thing front to back is probably about 5 inches long. That's 10 gigahertz standard gain horn. The exact same horn at 1 gigahertz, the guys who run the antenna range, they call it the coal hopper. The thing is about 3 feet wide, 2.5 feet high at the mouth. Huge, great big thing. It's about 50 pounds of sheet metal, if you know what I mean. And both of them are giving you, you could call it an impedance match to free space if you like. They both launch the signal with the exact same amount of gain at their appropriate frequency. And oh, by the way, the 1 gig horn is almost exactly 100 times bigger in every dimension compared to the 10 gig horn because the frequency ratio is, it's only 10 to 1 in that case. You and I would never use a standard gain horn at 100 megs. It would be almost as big as a house. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, that was my question. You answered it. Go on to Wes. I know he wanted to ask something.
Yeah, those lectures that were running for 2 or 3 days, Wes, I wonder how many of them you listened to. And my impression when I read the introductory works, because I had gone to the website after the event was over, but they described what they intended to lecture on each one of those lectures, and some of them struck me a little bit optimistic. I mean, the wording, for instance, on cold fusion was based on the assumption that cold fusion is a reality. It's already been proven. It's working like a charm, and now we're just going to make it into an industrial product. And I'm a little worried about that one. I don't think cold fusion has really been confirmed. I don't think various people thought they saw a little bit of it at times. Pons and I can't think of the other guy's name. They got an awful lot of flack because not everybody could, very few laboratories got even the hint of a reproduction of what they thought they saw. N2XJN, K2LAW.
Yeah, Dick, N2XJN. A little bit of a joke. I think you gave me 12 minutes just preparing the email. It took me half an hour. That's a joke. So, yeah, I think people have it on the burning side because it doesn't make sense even to touch the subject. Interesting.
Well, of all the lectures that you did witness, Wes, which one to you was the most interesting? Which one do you believe has the greatest benefit in the directions that you're seeking over the U.S.?
Okay, N2XJN. Well, first, there are two parts of email that I have covered there. One is building homemade nuclear reactor in New York City in Bedford. There is a number of people who made it. Unfortunately, national media didn't cover it. I took part in United Kingdom media and Russian media. There was, however, a lucky kid who met President Obama, who gave us a promise that if you have such a device, I want to know about it. He's a 15 years old kid. And he built a nuclear reactor. There are a few promising. So I think I'm going to cover this one because the other one, we don't have the time for it. Let me go. There are a few methods envisioned for doing that. One is nuclear fusion, the other one is fusion. Gamma decay, alpha decay, beta decay, and thorium is one of the promising ones, and that's how a number of people in the U.S. were able to build a nuclear reactor all based on it. Pretty much safe. As a matter of fact, we have a history of one pretty nice working one in the U.S., but it was shut down in the 60s and 70s. The guy in his apartment in Bedford, which is about 7 minutes driving time from my location, built a homemade nuclear reactor, and he was able to prove the concept. But then there was a number of people who were either complaining or saying, well, if he can help the humanity, why shouldn't he do it? Then there was another team that built a nuclear reactor in his basement as well. He was 18 years old. And, this one had beautiful, very expensive mechanics and electronics for it. So everything is in very inside. As far as the beta decay, actually it's foreseen that the beta decaying isotopes are the best homemade nuclear reactors, but it could be stopped by a piece of paper or tin aluminium, depends from what is the energy level, so that is always very much important to know. Low energy beta radiation in helium is not really very much radioactive, but it serves the purpose. Tritium, pretty easy to get and perfectly legal, and all of those they use as element called diffuser, so in high vacuum, but it's not a really high vacuum. I have 10 to minus 2 times 10 to minus 7 of Tor. They've been using 2 times the 10 to minus 4, so it's a pretty low vacuum for it. They were first evacuating it and then putting the thorium in it. Sometimes they do it in atmosphere of hydrogen. Andrea Rossi is launching. He's manufacturing in Florida. And probably we're going to see that change. So if you ask me which one is promising, I would say coming back to thorium is pretty much promising. Eventually, if I would be able to finish up Coleman, that would be much cheaper and doesn't require any vacuum at all. I have included in the email that was directed to the symposium, that was 3 days, I have included one link, which was the SLS, selective laser sintering, just for entertainment for the people so they don't get bored with all of this nuclear stuff. It looks like most of that conference was directed to some people that were trying to promote themselves. Tesla Foundation was also the one that was very heavily promoting themselves. I see that as a good sign because they're trying to expose a problem with Wundercliff Museum and have a fund for it. Actually, if one wants to build a nuclear reactor, it's a pretty inexpensive stuff. I believe whole electronics when bought cheaply would be about $2,000, and all of the mechanics another $2,000-$3,000, so about $5,000. I'm not intent to do it, but yes, it is working. So what they do, they use the heat exchange fuser. They concentrate the string of electrons into the very, very accurate point at which the heating is being done. And actually the extraction of the energy comes from the nuclear bonds. Definitely we're dealing with transmutation, and transmutation actually allows to change the nuclear structure. So in the effect we have a waste. But that waste is not radioactive, and it's a different kind of matter. Shortly, for some to explain, there are a few phenomena taking place, and being all of them are being used for the untapped to the energy production. One is the positron emitting, at which one proton disappear, one neutron appear, and then positron and neutrino is being detected with a high speed. When a positron is getting out, it collides with the electron, orbital electron, and then both of the particles destroy themselves as the mass of positron is exactly as the mass of the electron, and they create two photons at 100 degrees. Apart, that is also being used in medicine for the patch positron emitting spectroscopy. Another one is beta radiation. The beta radiation actually one neutron appear, one proton disappear, and actually, it's the reverse. One neutron disappear, one proton appears, so we're dealing with quite different content. So we have different matter. And then you have a gamma radiation in it as well. And then we have electron inhalation. You use the photon to affect the electron on the K-shelf. You have two scenarios. One of the scenarios is that that electron will be pushed inside the nuclei, or just that would be the nature of the substance that the electron is being captured. At that point, we have one more neutron, one less of the proton.
Minute.
Okay, and at that point, antineutrino and negatron, which is beta minus, leaving the nuclei. You are able to get that energy and utilize that energy, then we have the electricity production. So those are the three directions in it.
That home nuclear reactor, you mentioned fission, you mentioned fusion, and the fusion... Fusion sounds like it's a very, very difficult thing to do, but is the main intention there studying the technique? Is the main intention there to study these techniques? Do they intend to generate a significant amount of power? So other than the research portion of this, what do you believe, Wes, is the major goal of that home nuclear reactor? N2XJN, I'll be able to hear you on the input, K2RIW. I have to get used to the time delay. Wow. That's a pretty serious undertaking as I see it, Wes. You make it sound like these guys have found a way to make it affordable. And that amazing. That it's not super high in price. And I guess in some cases the neighbors are going to object if they find out that you've got a nuclear reactor in the house. Because the only thing I know of that people are more afraid of than RF radiation is nuclear radiation. Well, that scares the daylights out of them. If they find out you're doing it, you can't publish an article showing a picture of what you're doing in your living room. Because if the neighbor sees it, I think they're going to complain to some authority somewhere, not the supervisor of the building and so on. So I guess these are pretty enthusiastic people. And they have gone public by way of this series of lectures, haven't they? N2XJN, K2RIW. Almost everything I know about nuclear reactions tell me it's very difficult to get to that nucleus, Wes. That chemical reaction which involves the outer ring of electrons, yes, you can do that. But to penetrate that outer ring of electrons on every single element, to get down to the nucleus and do something, split it, add to it, whatever, until you've got a whole lot of material that's even giving you a critical mass, or nearly critical mass, or until you've got something like a particle accelerator that can accelerate your particles to close to the speed of light so that they can penetrate that outer shell of electrons, then I'm a bit worried that what some people think is a nuclear reaction might not be a nuclear reaction. And to prove that it's a nuclear reaction could be a little bit difficult. Back to you on that one, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW. I think you said the word dreamer. And in a way, I guess it's good to be optimistic. Okay. I'll see if I can review some more of that material, which I only see some of it so far. For those who can still hear me, if there's anybody out there, this was TechNet number 1471 of the series that began in September in 1982, 31 years ago and a month. Bye-bye, you all. See you later next week. And we'll almost settle this issue of antennas next week. That's a joke, of course. Oh,
note you for any other comments, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, all this is very interesting stuff, Dick. And I want to thank everybody for participating in the net tonight and joining us. God willing, we'll all be back here next week. And maybe we will solve the problem or two. Dick, you have a great week. I will talk to you on down the line. You also, Les.
Bye-bye, John. KQIAW, clear.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.